Well, the point of my talk today is really to attempt to clarify a concept which is probably the most misunderstood idea belonging to Marxist politics. And it's actually no accident that Lenin's theory of the vanguard party is so misunderstood. Because over the last 150 years of Marxist history and struggle, there's been a real living debate going on about what kind of socialist party it's necessary for revolutionaries to build. And throughout this history, the idea of the vanguard party, which is a party bringing together the most class-conscious, militant, active workers in struggle for the purpose of winning over the greatest number of workers to revolutionary politics, and so that they can eventually lead a successful workers' revolution, has been an idea that's been denigrated by other so-called left forces. And, you know, so on the one hand, modern-day reformist parties, like the ALP, have opposed the theory of a vanguard party. And like their predecessors in Lenin's time, the European Social Democrats, who from their actual revolutionary beginnings gradually came to aspire more and more to, you know, a parliamentary road to winning social reform, these reformists oppose the theory of a vanguard party, we've got to be clear, because they oppose its aims. A workers' revolution to sweep aside every vestige of the capitalist state and to replace it with workers' control, workers' power. And, you know, for the Labour Party, the aim isn't to advance workers' interests, it's actually capturing the parliamentary majority so that they themselves can manage, can run capitalism. And capturing this majority means, you know, appealing to all people, you know, all workers who can vote, not just the most revolutionary or the most left-wing. And it means, you know, you can look to sections outside of the working class for support too. So that's why the, you know, Labour Party, for instance, wouldn't stop millionaires like the former CEO of Channel 9, Eddie Maguire, from becoming party members or, you know, even from standing as party candidates in federal elections as they once hoped. But, you know, often it's people on the left who identify as socialists and radicals who have also criticised the concept of a vanguard party. And, you know, such socialists have argued that the best way to win greater numbers of people to socialism and increase the influence of revolutionaries in the working class is to build broad parties that unite all people who have some opposition to aspects of the system of capitalism, whether they be reformists, anarchists or socialist revolutionaries. And in Australia today, one example of a party that's argued for variants of this is the Democratic Socialist Perspective, or the DSP, which, you know, has argued for this kind of broad party organisation, you know, inherent in its project that it's sort of been the central to in the Socialist Alliance. And another criticism of the vanguard party has actually arisen from the historical reality of the Stalinist communist parties, who argue that they stood in the tradition of Lenin's vanguard party, the Bolsheviks, but which saw themselves as standing above the working class, dictating, you know, what the working class should think and what it shouldn't, and who saw its task as to opportunistically seize power at the right time and establish a new dictatorship. And those workers who didn't agree with these Stalinist parties could be murdered, and indeed, as history showed, they were. But Stalinism wasn't representative of revolutionary socialism. It was a real bastardisation of it. And the Stalinist model of the party, you know, this idea of an undemocratic cohort of hard revolutionaries with absolute authority in society, was actually the blunt instrument used to bludgeon the heads of, you know, any workers who tried to oppose Stalin's counter-revolution in Russia and, you know, who spoke against the exploitation and oppression of the Stalinist states. So in this talk, you know, given this history, I will outline the actual characteristics of the vanguard party as theorised by Lenin. And I will argue that the Leninist conception of the vanguard party isn't, as it's often argued, an elitist concept, nor does it have anything in common with the Stalinist myth of the monolithic party, you know, imposing its will on the working class from above and outside of it. Rather, Lenin argued for a party with firm roots in the working class, and with the collective experience and determination to lead everyday workers' struggles, and then, you know, with a capability wrought through this struggle to ultimately lead the working class to victory in revolutionary situations. And just before I get into the meat of my talk, one qualification that I want to make is that Socialist Alternative is not a vanguard party today. And the party that we're talking about in the context that Lenin intended actually refers to a mass party with, you know, roots in the working class and at least tens of thousands of worker members. But the question of what kind of a party revolutionaries will need to build is important to grasp today, because the more people who are clearer about this now, the more chance, you know, I think we'll have for laying the basis for such a, you know, vanguard party in the future. So the starting point for understanding Lenin's insistence on the need for a vanguard party is understanding that this concept was based on the idea that the working class couldn't be liberated by anyone standing outside or above its ranks. But that, as Marx had argued in the Communist Manifesto, the emancipation of the working class must be conquered by the working class themselves. And it was for this reason that, you know, with the outbreak of World War I, Lenin actually came to reject social democracy, or so-called, you know, parliamentary socialism, that was embodied in the German SPD, which was the largest socialist party in the world at the time. Apart from its mass membership, the SPD had managed to gain considerable influence in the trade union movement and in the German parliament. And so from its revolutionary beginnings, it began to place more and more of an emphasis on trying to win social reforms through the parliament. And the SPD had virtually remained unchallenged in the world socialist movement as, you know, the model of an ideal, what an ideal socialist party would look like, up until 1914, when the parliamentary representatives of the SPD in the German parliament lined up with a German capitalist to actually support World War I and, you know, directly against the interests of workers the world over who would be sent to their slaughter in this imperialist conflict. And for Lenin, this accommodation to the interests of the capitalist class by the SPD confirmed that workers could look to no force other than themselves to make a workers' revolution. And he began to more sharply pose than he had previously what the nature of the revolutionary party should be. And so from the starting point that the struggle for socialism can only be led by the working class, Lenin argued that any truly revolutionary party would, you know, require, for a start, a program of absolute commitment, of being totally on the side of workers, and also a working class membership. But in arguing the working class is the only force in society that has the interests and power to make a revolution in the interests of workers, the question arises, well, you know, capitalism is this awful system, so, you know, why haven't workers already emancipated themselves? And for Lenin, the answer to this question was uneven class consciousness. And, you know, what does this mean? This is simply the fact that because we all have different experiences and backgrounds, workers view capitalist society in different ways. Some workers, you know, express a rejection of the status quo, and others some forms of acceptance of it. So, for example, you know, some workers can easily identify that, you know, the boss is the main enemy. Others may refuse to join a union and accept most of their, you know, boss's ideas, or vote for the open party of big business, the Liberals. And then most other workers will fall somewhere in between most times, holding some, you know, progressive ideas and some right-wing ones. And it's this reality that for Lenin pointed to why revolutionaries needed to specifically build a vanguard party. That is, a party to organise the most left-wing and class-conscious workers in society. A party with clear revolutionary politics and an understanding of both the nature of the capitalist system and also of the history of working class struggles against it. And I think to explain this a bit further, you have to see that capitalists don't just maintain their rule through brute force, although this is often the case. More often than not, violence isn't necessary to keep workers in line, to keep them going to work on a daily basis, because the dominant ideas in society at any time are the ideas of the ruling class, those ideas that actually back up, you know, the state the world's in today and the situation of workers. The ruling class's ideas are disseminated through all of the institutions in capitalist society. You know, perhaps the most obvious, I think, to people is the mass media, which on any given day, you know, could tell us that the main threat to our lives, you know, isn't the bosses and their work choices laws, you know, but that it's actually, you know, Muslims intent on destroying our way of life, whatever that may mean. Or, you know, for instance, the education system, which teaches us subservience to authority figures and socializes us into the ideas that we should just accept society the way it is, that ordinary people can't really change the world, and that if they do, they'll end up with something worse than capitalism, you know, a horrible Stalinist dictatorship. And that's what I learned in year 12. And these ideas necessarily have an impact on all of us. And in periods of low social struggle, it can seem like workers will always passively accept the ideas of the ruling class. Now, this isn't to say that all workers are just duped into accepting capitalism, that we just believe everything that we see on TV, or that we're, you know, too stupid to see the need for fundamental change in our society. It simply means that individual workers will have different degrees of consciousness about, you know, the possibility for social change at any given time. And any of our workplaces, I'm sure, will be an illustration of this fact. Because at any time, you know, we could work alongside people who think that capitalism is the best way of organising society, even if they don't think it's a perfect way to do it, and they don't like, you know, inequality or poverty. Or we could work with someone, you know, who's racist and blames refugees, you know, trying to take our jobs for attacks on our wages and conditions. And, you know, so some workers will accept the propaganda of, you know, the war on terror as well. But at the same time, there are workers, you know, people like me, who will reject racism outright in the name of standing in solidarity with workers all around the world. And in fact, the Australian, you know, trade union movement and workers here have a long history, a proud history of actually standing alongside, for instance, black workers fighting the South African apartheid regime. And importantly, it's capitalism that forces workers into struggle, to fight to oppose attacks on our rights and conditions. And it's in this process of having to defend ourselves to fight back against the attacks from our bosses that the capitalist values of competition, of greed and self-interest that we have foisted on us can be challenged and replaced by the ideas of solidarity, of equality and cooperation amongst workers. And because struggle shows us that we do have social power, that, you know, it can matter when we take a stand, workers can come to quite, you know, revolutionary ideas in the course of fighting back against the attacks of capitalism. Even, I think it's important to see, without the existence of revolutionaries to lead these struggles. And in his time, the 1905 Russian Revolution really served Lenin with an example of this dynamic of struggle. And the 1905 revolution was a key event in which workers broke out of their passivity, their perceived passivity, and struck against the oppressive Tsarist regime. And there were few socialist groups actually involved in the Russian Revolution in 1905, and those that did exist were quite small. And so reflecting on the revolution, Lenin wrote, "In revolutions, there come to light contradictions that have ripened for decades. Life becomes unusually eventful. The masses, which have always stood in the shade and therefore have often been despised by superficial observers, that is, you know, undermined, not taken seriously, they enter the political arena as active combatants." And Lenin observed, workers who had previously thought perhaps very little about politics, trying to actually grapple with overthrowing the whole of the old regime, you know, and what he, and doing what he called making heroic efforts to rise to the occasion and cope with the gigantic tasks of world significance imposed upon them by history. So the 1905 revolution was an inspiring example of workers, you know, initiative and ability to take up revolutionary ideas without, you know, this help from organised revolutionaries. And following 1905, Lenin actually wrote that in periods of revolutionary struggle, the working class feels an instinctive urge for open revolutionary action, and that in such periods, the elementary instinct of the working class movement is able to correct the conceptions of the greatest minds. And if we could take a pretty literal translation of that, I'd say that means that when workers fight, they can teach socialists a thing or two. After all, in Russia, it was workers who independently created Soviets, the most democratic bodies ever seen for the coordination of the struggle and, you know, representation of workers' interests. But the 1905 revolution was actually put down, able to be put down by the Tsarist state, and it was followed by a period of extreme repression. And it was this experience that gave Lenin the insight that the Revolutionary Party needed to organise the most advanced, class-conscious and active sections of the working class. You know, that is the vanguard that I've spoken about. Because although it was clear that workers could fight for revolution without revolutionaries, it was also clear that for revolutions to succeed, something more would be needed. The intervention of revolutionaries with a political clarity to assess the situation and to win workers, you know, to the next necessary step in the struggles. So in 1905, with, you know, masses of workers entering into armed confrontation with the state, this next step, you know, that revolutionaries needed to press for was actually for workers to take state power, to actually start to run society, and, you know, resist the state's attempts to kind of diffuse or divert their struggle by setting up sham parliaments or any such thing, which is actually what did start to happen in Russia. So I suppose to sort of summarise, part of the role of the vanguard party is to play an educational role as a party that recognises that, you know, capitalist ideas are dominant in society and which strives to win as many workers as possible to Marxist ideas and you know, a Marxist conception of history as a prism through which to view their lives. In order to fight for socialism, workers need to be won on more than just the level of, you know, of economics. They need to be trained to oppose all, you know, of the oppression of capitalism, to take on all of its incidences of brutality, of racism and sexism and so on. And this is important because it's these artificial divisions that are fostered by the ruling class that must be overcome for the radical transformation of society to be possible. And, you know, I've already identified the role that struggle plays in fostering solidarity amongst workers, and this solidarity can start to call into questions these divisions of sex, of race that are constantly being stirred up by our rulers. Because workers can more clearly see that, you know, when bosses pit us up against each other, we are weak, and that actually when we unite in collective action and overcome these divisions, we can fight back more effectively. But even during struggles, when this dynamic is happening, some workers are going to be able to more readily see this than others. Some people are going to more, you know, readily come to the fore of these struggles. So a vanguard party has a real role to play in these situations of struggle in generalising out the lesson that if in any part of the working class is oppressed, it makes it easier for the bosses to keep all of us down. That, you know, we need a maximum amount of unity amongst ourselves if we're going to win. Moreover, you know, genuine revolutionaries aren't interested in papering over these differences in people's, you know, in workers' consciousness that I've outlined. The task of the Revolutionary Party is to actually try and raise the consciousness of, you know, the newest members, the people who it's got around its periphery, to be able to ensure, to the level of its oldest and most experienced members, to be able to ensure that the vanguard, you know, has a confident knowledge of the nature of the system and the history of the struggles against it, so it can, you know, argue the actual way forward in struggles. As the British socialist Chris Harman outlined in his essay Party and Class, which you can also find on the bookstall outside, the function of the vanguard party is to carry out continual agitation and propaganda among less advanced sections of the working class so as to raise their consciousness and self-reliance. But a vanguard party isn't just required to convince all workers that we need to stand up against oppression, but also because in every struggle, there will be some leadership that comes to the fore to influence the outcome of that struggle. So if revolutionaries don't win the leadership of the struggles, reformist ideas and reformist leaders who already have influence with workers, you know, like the trade union officials, like the, you know, leaders in the Labour Party will. Because most of the time under capitalism, workers will be influenced by reformist ideas. And that's because there's a material basis for these ideas in our everyday experience. We don't actually run society. We don't actually have, you know, the power to make life and death decisions that our rulers do about whether or not to go to war. We don't get to decide how the world's vast resources will be spent or, you know, even what we'll do when we get to work and sit at our desk every morning. Those sorts of things are things that we don't really control. And so our experience of being a worker in capitalism can make us feel powerless and will have taught us to, you know, defer to some other force than ourselves to lead and make decisions about, you know, the way society will be run, likewise the direction that our struggles should take when we actually start to fight back against the system. So it's going to take the conscious intervention of revolutionaries arguing for socialism to break workers from, you know, these reformist ideas and their and reformist leaders who are consciously committed only to opposing the worst excesses of capitalism, if that, and not getting rid of the whole system, and who because of this want to limit and contain workers' struggles. And a recent example of this role of, you know, reformists, I think, is the campaign against the work choices laws, where, you know, instead of calling for the kinds of mass strikes to crush the anti-worker laws that could have actually made the laws a dead letter, the trade union officials, the ACTU, called, you know, more and more for a focus on getting the Labor Party voted into office to get rid of the laws for us. And I think, you know, as it stands, it's pretty clear that because Labor want to manage Australian capitalism, they have no intention of scrapping the entirety of Howard's laws. So, you know, as we've seen over the last week, they've, you know, outlawed any new AWA's individual contracts, but existing ones will remain. And all of the other anti-union measures that are contained in Howard's work choices laws will continue. Strikes will remain, in the large part, illegal. So, I mean, I think that it's important to see that the people in society with authority to challenge the leadership of the reformists amongst the working class is the vanguard. You know, those workers who have been involved in struggles and can actually, you know, have authority to challenge the reformist leaders because of their credibility gained through, you know, their everyday participation in the struggles of the working class. And, you know, even though, as I've said, workers themselves can come to revolutionary conclusions, without the conscious intervention of revolutionaries, these ideas, I think, can just dissipate or subside with the ebb and flow of struggle. So in this way, the Revolutionary Party is also necessary to play the important role of crystallising the lessons that we learn out of the struggles, to act as what Lenin called the memory of the class. And, you know, this is simply because workers aren't involved in mass strikes or revolutionary uprisings on a daily basis. So new generations of workers won't necessarily have the, you know, same experiences to draw on, and lessons learned out of, you know, periods of struggle that can be so important for us can be forgotten. Okay, well, it was because Lenin saw the vanguard party as needing to embody revolutionary ideas and theory, as well as to act as a memory of the class, that it couldn't just be the same as some, you know, other mass organisations of the working class, like trade unions or the reformist parties like the ALP, that purport to just represent all workers, whatever their consciousness, and which limit themselves to fighting the effects of the system and not the system itself. So this isn't to say, though, that revolutionaries, you know, spurn trade unions. No, we support them as organisations that allow workers to organise collectively to defend our rights, and we're members of unions and we work within them. Nor is it to say that we'll never work alongside, you know, reformist parties in campaigns, but simply that revolutionaries need separate organisation. They need to unite their members around clear revolutionary politics. Now, as we've seen, the party is needed to play an educational role, but the party isn't just an ideas machine, it's an activist body. The purpose of having political clarity and education of the vanguard is so that they can have the confidence, as I've said, to lead in struggle and to know what is necessary to do in any situation to push our struggles forward. And it's this aim of the Revolutionary Party that determines how the Revolutionary Party should be organised. And that's what I want to spend the rest of my time talking about. And I want to say as well that there are other features of the Revolutionary Party that I won't get time to go over, but I'm going to go over the ones that I think are central. And I think the first one is an active membership. The Vanguard Party demands an active membership. For reformist parties like, you know, the Labor Party, whose battleground is Parliament, and, you know, whose leaders are the parliamentary representatives, people like Kevin Rudd, who are, you know, largely unaccountable to their membership. At most, such parties require that their membership will, you know, hand out how to vote cards for them at the next federal election, or, as in my experience as a member of the Labor Party, you know, pretend that you've gone along to branch meetings which you haven't ever really gone to at all. So you could literally, you know, be dead and be a member of the Labor Party. In contrast, the Vanguard Party requires all of its members to lead. To, you know, argue by intervening in the struggle, by selling its paper to workers, by attending meetings to debate out our politics and our strategies. And this is because the purpose of the Vanguard Party is to convince more workers of socialism. And so its members can't just be the people with good ideas in their heads. Their ability to win people to these ideas is going to depend absolutely on their participation in all working class struggles. So, you know, the Vanguard Party requires a dedication of its members that most workers, you know, probably won't have all the time under capitalism. The dedication to be serious and disciplined enough to want to engage in political debate and to take, you know, the outcomes of this debate seriously, as well as the dedication to be a committed and ongoing activist. And this discipline is clearly not the same as the discipline of, you know, by the Stalinist definition of unquestioning adherence to a party line, but rather discipline in the context of actual voluntary commitment to an organisation, to be part of building an organisation based on a commonly accepted programme, you know, and, you know, for being on the side of the working class. And if the party is going to be able to learn the lessons necessary to work out what arguments to make in a struggle and to get an honest assessment of how it's gone in doing this, the party needs to be democratic. And that's the other key feature of Lenin's theory of a vanguard party. It requires the participation of its activists in discussion to feed back their experiences of trying to make the arguments and applying, you know, the tactics that the party has decided on. And the more people who are engaged in these kinds of discussions, the better assessment the Vanguard Party will have of its impact, its ability to actually lead workers' struggles successfully, and so on. Or, you know, on the other hand, of the failure of its strategies and, you know, and its arguments. And the other reason why the Vanguard Party has to be democratic is that an expectation of, you know, blind loyalty to a party line within a membership wouldn't really train people to be very convincing revolutionaries. In fact, the only way that the party can train, you know, the Vanguard to lead the working class is if they win them through debate and argument to a Marxist position. And likewise, the Vanguard isn't going to be able to win other workers to socialism by, you know, imposing socialism on them. Well, you know, you can imagine a situation. They're not going to actually win workers on a picket line to their position by just rocking up, you know, to that picket line or a mass meeting and saying, hey, hi, I'm a revolutionary, I'm Rebecca, and you better listen to me because I know, you know, the best way forward in this struggle. You can imagine what kind of reception you'd get if you did that, and rightly so. The Vanguard will need to win workers, you know, to socialism through debate and argument during the course, as I've said, of their participation in struggle. So to Lenin, democracy wasn't just this, you know, fuzzy, feel-good, optional extra for democracy's sake or, you know, whatever, so that everyone could feel good. It was vital if the party was going to be able to operate effectively. And this really flies in the face of the Stalinist caricature, I suppose, of the Vanguard Party. Of course, the Stalinist parties weren't democratic. Their aim was never to lead workers in a struggle to liberate themselves, but was to exploit and oppress workers to consolidate their own power and privilege. And the last characteristic of the Vanguard Party that I'll have time to go over, because I'm conscious of the time, is that it must be centralist. And this, you know, this idea has often struck fear into the, you know, hearts, I suppose, of left-wing people who would otherwise support the idea of a Vanguard Party. But I think that by centralist, we have to be clear, this simply means that the party has to be able to act in a cohered, and unified way, not as a series of dispersed fragments that just go off and do, you know, whatever they like. The party has to be centralist precisely because the party is a party that wants to actually act and have an impact on the world, to actually take a stand against capitalism and participate in all of the struggles, you know, of the day. The party, as I said, in that sense, is a combative organisation that needs to be able to answer the most crucial question in any struggle: what do we do next? Through a process of democratic debate, and then be able to go away and try and implement the answer that we've come up with together to try and move the struggle forward. So revolutionary centralism has nothing to do with, like, the bureaucracy or centralism of the Labour Party. It's merely a response to the reality that the capitalist state is centralised and will use its forces, you know, the army, the police force, to break up workers' struggle when they happen. And it's fairly obvious that any successful struggle requires coordination or, you know, centralisation, to use another word. And to see this, we just need to look at any strike. If you want to win a strike, you need to get everyone to agree to go on strike. Otherwise, the capitalists are going to be able to use, you know, scabs, workers that refuse to strike, to undermine the struggle and force workers back to work. Or even if you take the example that I raised earlier of the Work Choices campaign, well, such a campaign wouldn't have been very effective at all if it had just been left to one or two unions to actually, you know, come out and mobilise their members against the Work Choices laws. And if centralisation is necessary in everyday struggles and campaigns, then it makes sense that revolution, the act of workers collectively coming together to get rid of the capitalist state and to replace it with workers' power, will need to be centralised, or else the capitalists, you know, will be able to isolate workers pretty quickly and put down the movement. So, you know, to sum up, I suppose, the connection between democracy and centralism in the Vanguard Party, Lenin had a slogan which I think does that, and it was unity of action, freedom of discussion and criticism within the party. And it's these features of the Vanguard Party that I've talked about, you know, its active membership, its, you know, centralisation and democracy that, you know, make it able to be an effective activist in the momentary kind of struggles for the class and its interests, and also to lay the basis for revolutionary struggles in the future that can actually push forward. And that's why, by contrast as well, both reformist parties and broad parties are constrained from acting in the manner necessary to challenge capitalism. And in the case of the reformists, which I'm not going to spend much time on, this isn't surprising, as I've said, their aim isn't to shake the foundations of the system and bosses' rule at all, despite, you know, the hallucinations of the Labour Left students or whoever. In the case of the broad party, whose advocates may identify as socialists or revolutionaries, the fact that it aims to bring together, you know, all sorts of left-wing people with all sorts of different ideas, reformists, you know, socialists, and, you know, all people in between, with all different sorts of goals as well coming out of their politics, well, this is actually a project that's a recipe for paralysis at critical times, even well short of revolutionary situations. And for a prime illustration of this, we don't need to look back as far as Lenin's day, because there's the more recent example of communist refoundation in Italy. And I won't have all this time to elaborate on this, but we can come back to it in the discussion, but I'll briefly outline communist refoundation, what it was. This was a broad party that was originally formed as a left-wing split from the increasingly right-wing Italian Communist Party. And Refoundation decided, actually, to just recently, to form an alliance with the, you know, right-wing party, centre-right parties, and join the ruling centre-left coalition government, which is currently implementing neoliberal reforms and a neoliberal agenda in Italy. And so, you know, when the government, this centre-left government, was deciding to extend the presence of Italian troops in Afghanistan, the right wing of the party, of Refoundation, actually had the majority over the revolutionary section of Refoundation and voted to maintain the troop presence. And so at this crisis point, you know, when actually the decision is there going to be, you know, continued presence of troops in Afghanistan to continue this imperialist war, Italian revolutionaries in Refoundation weren't even part of an organisation that could move decisively to oppose the war in Afghanistan. And I think that this really shows the bankruptcy of the broad party model. Because at times of crisis, you know, like I said, well short of a revolutionary situation, like the outbreak of a war and so on, the reformists of a right or a right wing of, you know, a broad party will at best leave the party, or at worst, they'll assume the majority and act against the interests of the working class. And so, you know, I would argue that building a broad party is actually a diversion from the patient but necessary work of trying to win the most left-wing and class-conscious workers in society to socialist politics. And although they may seem like a way for socialists to fast-track their, you know, their way out of the present situation where we don't have all of this influence amongst the working class and in the trade unions and so on, in the end, as the example of Refoundation shows, they can be a real barrier to advancing, you know, the interests of workers and class struggle, because they can't even, as I've outlined, stand in a principled opposition to the wars of the capitalist class. But the last thing that I wanted to address was the, you know, other kind of, I suppose, criticism that often gets raised or questioned about Lenin's theory of the Vanguard Party, and that is that such a party is elitist. And I think the first thing to say in response to the charge of elitism is that the Vanguard Party isn't outside of or absolutely cut off from the working class. It's not some separate section that's, you know, united for the purpose of substituting its unique interests for those of the whole class. And importantly, although a Vanguard Party organises the most advanced section of the working class, it doesn't want to stay a tiny minority. And actually, that's what the real nature of an elite is. It's a group in society that wants to maintain itself as a small and, you know, privileged, you know, select few people. the Vanguard Party wants to win as much of the working class as is possible to, you know, to its politics, to its advanced position. And, you know, so even though the party plays the special roles that I've outlined of, you know, remembering the lessons of past workers' struggles, as I've said, these lessons aren't dead, but are constantly tested in struggle. And although the party's members are politically ahead of the rest of the working class, this doesn't mean that they aren't constantly learning from the struggle, just as Lenin and revolutionaries did in 1905. In this sense, the party isn't an elite dictating to the masses, but as American socialist Paul D'Amato puts it in his book, The Meaning of Marxism, the party's relationship to the rest of the working class is as a grouping of comrades in struggle, who, in participating in today's movements, try to move the struggle as far as it can go, introducing to wider layers of workers the need for a socialist alternative to capitalism along the way. So I'm going to conclude now by saying that, you know, just a cursory glance at the world today, riddled with inequality, the brutality of wars, attacks on Aboriginal rights and so on, shows the need for fundamental social change. And the flip side of the grim reality of capitalism in the 21st century is the resistance of workers that we've been hearing about throughout the whole course of this conference this weekend, of, you know, the resistance of Chinese workers, of US soldiers rejecting the logic of the, you know, their state's war machine and refusing any longer to fight the war in Iraq, of the South African working class against privatisation and neoliberal attacks from their ANC government. But these struggles absolutely highlight the need for revolutionary organisation. Today, just as when Lenin theorised the Vanguard Party, there's a need for socialists to build organisations of revolutionaries with the right politics to be able to challenge, in a principled way, every part of the capitalist system, but also with the experience and historical knowledge of past workers' struggles and with a confident and active membership that can win greater numbers of workers away from what Chris Harman called their ideological subservience to the old society. And to win them to socialism. That's what we stand for. For workers-controlled society, a society whose resources are turned towards meeting human need, not amassing profits for a tiny minority of people at the top of society. But even well short of revolutionary situations, a Vanguard Party that can share, you know, its ideas, its experience of past struggles, and with a clear sense of the necessary tasks for workers in the here and now, could actually lead the kinds of struggles that we're seeing and that do occur today to victory. And that's why, you know, for example, in the Anti-Work Choices campaign, had there been such a party in existence, it's totally conceivable that we could have crushed these laws. And as I said, Socialist Alternative isn't a revolutionary vanguard party, but the larger the group of people that we can cohere today who can argue for the politics of revolutionary Marxism and who have this experience, who are activists today, well, the better the chance we'll have that in the future a mass party will be formed that can lead, you know, workers' campaigns to victory and ultimately to get rid of the barbarous capitalist system for good.